This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Despite the still raging COVID-19 vaccine and the pandemic, more than 100 world leaders are planning to head to New York for the annual high-level UN gathering. The challenges on the global agenda are daunting, from an escalating climate crisis and vaccine inequities to Afghanistan's uncertain future under its new Taliban rulers and worsening conflicts in Ethiopia's Tigray region and Myanmar. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres keeps repeating that the world is at a pivotal moment and cannot continue business as usual. He says it must shift gears to a greener and safer world. France's government spokesman says President Emmanuel Macron will speak in the coming days with U.S. President Joe Biden in their first contact since a major crisis erupted between France and the United States over a submarine deal with Australia. The French spokesman said Sunday that the phone call is at the request of Biden. What the French now call a grave crisis erupted over the surprise end to a 2016 contract for France to build 12 conventional diesel electric submarines for Australia. But Australia belatedly signed on with the United States and Britain for nuclear power submarines. France recalled its ambassadors to the two countries, but the French government insists the problem is firstly about strategic issues in the Indo-Pacific region where China is raising its influence. Again, France's government spokesman says that President Emmanuel Macron is planning to speak in the coming days with U.S. President Joe Biden over the issue. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. The U.S. is flying Haitians camped in a Texas border town back to their homeland and trying to block others from crossing the border from Mexico. It's a massive show of force that signals the beginning of what could be one of America's swiftest large-scale expulsions of migrants or refugees in decades. Three flights with 145 passengers each arrived in Port-au-Prince in Haiti, and six flights were expected Tuesday. In all, U.S. authorities moved to expel many of the 12,000 migrants camped around a bridge in Del Rio, Texas, after crossing from Mexico. The National Institutes of Health director says a government advisory panel's decision to limit Pfizer COVID-19 booster shots to 65 and older Americans, as well as those who are high risk of severe disease, is a preliminary step and predicts broader approval for most Americans in the next few weeks. Dr. Francis Collins told the Fox News Sunday that the panel's recommendation Friday was correct based on a snapshot of available data on the effectiveness of Pfizer's two-shot regimen over time, but he said real-time data from the U.S. and Israel continue to come in, showing waning efficacy among broader groups of people that will need to be addressed soon. Collins, who also appeared on CBS's Face the Nation, said that, "I think there will be a decision in the coming weeks to extend boosters beyond the list that they approved on Friday." Female employees in the Kabul city government have been told to stay home, with work only allowed for those who cannot be replaced by men. The interim mayor of Afghanistan's capital said Sunday, detailing the last restrictions on women by the new Taliban rulers. Witnesses, meanwhile, said an explosion targeted a Taliban vehicle in the eastern provincial city of Jalalabad, and hospital officials said five people were killed in the second such deadly blast in as many days in the Islamic State stronghold. A decision to prevent most female city workers from returning to their jobs is another sign that the Taliban, who overran Kabul last month, are enforcing their harsh interpretation of Islam, despite initial promises by some that they would be tolerant and inclusive. In their previous rule in the 1990s, the Taliban had barred girls and women from schools, jobs, and public life. There is more at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Batty in Washington. Today is Monday, September 20, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A verdict is expected today in the trial of Paul Rusesabagina of Rwanda.
Whether or not the court will give a life sentence or will give a sentence of a number of years, 20 years, 30 years, we don't know and we can't predict that. But what we do know is that the trial process fell so far below internationally recognized standards for a fair trial.
A U.S. court convicts a Liberian warlord of crimes against humanity. WHO warns that COVID-19 vaccine export bans will prolong the pandemic in Africa. Kenya unveils its agenda as president of the UN Peace and Security Organ. And Guinea's military junta meets with civil society today on the last day of consultations.
We know, even under normal circumstances, to have an election organized in 6 months in a country like Guinea, given all that had happened, given all the disagreements on the border role, it's unrealistic.
And Malawi plans a nationwide rollout of the new typhoid vaccine. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Rwanda's Supreme Court will today, September 20, render its judgment in the trial of Paul Rusesabagina and 20 others accused of terrorism against the Rwandan government. Rusesabagina, who was portrayed in the movie Hotel Rwanda because of his humanitarian work during the 1994 Rwanda genocide, was arrested in August 2020 while in transit and extradited to Rwanda. He and 20 others are charged with 13 criminal offenses for their alleged connection to the FLN, the militia group that the Rwandan government accuses of terrorism. Rusesabagina has denied the charges. Reports in the New Times of Rwanda says prosecutors have asked for a life sentence for Rusesabagina. Kit Gibson is one of Rusesabagina's lawyers from Geneva, Switzerland. She says whatever today's verdict will be, the trial did not meet international standards for a fair trial.
Rusesabagina's family and his legal team are fully expecting that on Monday, the chamber that has been hearing his case will render a conviction. So that is a verdict of guilty. It's our opinion that this is the end of a story that was scripted and written even before Mr. Rusesabagina was kidnapped in August of 2020, that there was always a deliberate and decided plan in place that he would be put on trial and convicted by the Rwandan judicial authorities.
According to one account in Rwandan papers, the prosecution is seeking a life sentence for Mr. Rusesabagina.
Yes, we saw that during the proceedings. The prosecution obviously has the right to seek a particular sentence for each of the co-accused, and for Mr. Rusesabagina, they asked for a life sentence. Whether or not the court will give a life sentence or will give a sentence of a number of years, 20 years, 30 years, we don't know and we can't predict that. But what we do know is that the trial process to which Mr. Rusesabagina was fell so far below internationally recognized standards for a fair trial that the verdict itself is of no particular consequence. It's an empty verdict because the proceedings that went before it was so manifestly unfair. And that's not just Paul's family who's saying that. It's not just Paul's legal team who's saying that. Independent international monitors followed the trial proceedings and took the extraordinary step of issuing a trial monitoring report in advance of the verdict, saying this trial was so unfair and the violations of Paul's rights were so manifest and systematic that they call into question any eventual verdict. And that's where we are now. Whatever verdict is rendered on Monday is undermined in full by the fact that the accused, Mr. Rusesabagina, did not receive a fair trial.
Can you elaborate? What do you mean that he did not receive a fair trial?
International conventions to which Rwanda is a party, which Rwanda has signed, set out minimum standards of fair trial rights that must be afforded to anyone who's accused of a crime anywhere in the world. And these are basic rights such as the right to legal assistance, the right to adequate time and facilities to prepare, and the right to be presumed innocent. And we see, even in days after Paul's arrest, high-ranking members of the Rwandan authorities, including the president, came out and said that Paul was guilty. So that's a violation of his right to be presumed innocent. But more than that, Paul wasn't given a copy of his case file. He wasn't allowed to prepare for the trial. His lawyers weren't allowed to bring materials into him. Any legal documents that they tried to discuss with him were confiscated and were read at the highest levels of government. Paul wasn't allowed to have the lawyers of his choosing. The violations of his rights basically read as a checklist of all the things that you shouldn't do to an accused.
Kit, thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you as we are with the verdict. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, James, for your time, and thank you for continuing to talk about Paul and this case. We're very grateful.
Kit Gibson is one of the lawyers for Paul Rusesabagina of Rwanda. She was speaking with us from Geneva, Switzerland. In Guinea, the first round of consultations between the military junta and Guinean politicians, religious leaders, elders, and civil society is expected to conclude today, Monday, with a meeting between the junta and members of the civil society. This comes after the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, last Friday suspended Guinea from the regional bloc, imposed travel bans on the junta and their family members, froze their assets, and gave a six-month timeline within which the junta should hold presidential and legislative elections. Edward Haba is a member of the diaspora from the United States who will be attending Monday's meeting with the junta as part of the Guinean civil society. He says the directive by ECOWAS to hold elections within 6 months is unrealistic and an attempt to set up Guinea for yet another failure.
Everything is fluid on the ground. There is no uprising, there is no unrest. If anything, the population is happy. They receive the coup as a liberation. People are hopeful that from here on, something better could happen, something new could come out of this that will take the country forward.
As you know, ECOWAS has given the military junta 6 months to hold presidential and legislative elections. For someone like you who is not in the military junta, what's your view on this directive from ECOWAS?
I understand the position and the director from ECOWAS. At the same time, we have to be realistic and pragmatic. We know, even under normal circumstances, to have an election organized, and we're talking about two elections, legislative and presidential, in 6 months, in a country like Guinea, given all that had happened, given all the disagreement on the border role, it's unrealistic. It's just setting the country up for another failure. That's the mistake that was made in 2008, 2010, when they rushed things. So this time, I believe it will be wise to give the junta some time to be able to clean things up, to come up with a better voter roll, because the political parties, they don't agree with the voter roll. So we won't be able to say we're going to come up with a new voter roll in 6 months, organize the election in 6 months. It's just unrealistic.
What view do you think is floating in Guinea about the transition length?
The view that is trending here, based on my assessment on the ground, is to give the junta the necessary time to be able to organize things. And that is ranging mostly somewhere between the 2 years to 3 years time frame. Some people are even throwing the idea of letting them take 5 years, which I think is too much.
Remember that ECOWAS is concerned about what it calls the resurgence of coup d'etats in West Africa.
We know that there are concerns about that, and we also hope that there would have been concern about president changing the constitution in their countries to stay in power for extra times. And that's where it's not adding up when we see ECOWAS condemning the military coups, but yet favoring the constitutional coups that have been taking place throughout West Africa. That's just the basic disconnect.
Edward Habad is a member of the diaspora who traveled to Conakry for consultation on the invitation of the military junta. He was speaking with us from Guinea's capital, Conakry. A U.S. court has convicted a former Liberian military commander of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Colonel Moses Thomas was held liable for the killing of about 600 civilians who were sheltering in a church during Liberia's first civil war on July 29, 1990. As Rita Jolabwe reports from Monrovia, Thomas has denied any involvement in the killings.
Four survivors of the massacre filed a lawsuit against Moses Thomas in 2018 in the U.S. District Court of Pennsylvania, where Thomas resided from 2000 to 2019. On September 16, 2021, the court found that Thomas, as commander of the armed forces of Liberia's elite special anti-terrorist unit, SATU, ordered a massacre that claimed the lives of about 600 civilians who were seeking refuge at the St. Peter's Lutheran Church in Cinco, Monrovia. The U.S. court found Thomas guilty of war crimes, crimes against humanity, extrajudicial killing, and torture. But Thomas, who is currently residing in Liberia since 2019, denies any involvement in the alleged crimes. He told the local independent Pope newspaper that the judgment is nonsense.
They say our commander of the army. I'm not a commander of the army. I'm not a minister of defense. I'm not a commanding general. So why they will say I'm commander of the army, I have an authority to have stopped the massacre. They say I'm responsible for the Lutheran massacre. I'm not the only one. They even bring one army person that I directed, authorized, I commanded, one or two persons from somewhere who was the whole Moses, or Moses. They just assuming. Can one person do that? Let them bring one person.
Thomas says he was never granted a privilege to challenge their persecution evidence.
They have not allowed my lawyer to interview the so-called victim that they're talking about. In America, you got to allow your lawyer to interview them. They're just saying for the people's security. So since they're dealing with law firm, I ain't got no money for lawyers. So for me, it's just nonsense. They got no evidence. And let me be frank with you. Every human rights person in this country, no one person will ever tell you I've been involved into human rights violation, into anything in my life.
The complainants who prefer to be anonymous for fear of retaliation are represented by the Center for Justice and Accountability, along with other legal institutions. Nushin Sakarati, a lawyer representing the plaintiffs, says Thomas's lawyer was given the chance to challenge the evidence, but did not convince the judge.
Thomas has had every opportunity to defend himself in this case, and he has been defending himself. He has an attorney representing him. We've presented all the evidence that we've collected to date before the judge. Thomas has also had the opportunity to present his evidence to the judge. Still, the judge determined that Thomas was indeed liable for this attack and that the evidence is overwhelming. I do hope that today's verdict will give some hope for the establishment of a war crimes court in Liberia.
Hassan Beliti, executive director of the Monrovia-based Global Justice Research Project, said in a statement to VOA that for more than two decades, Liberians have known that their government perpetrated the Lutheran Church massacre. Rita Jrabwe for VOA News, Monrovia, Liberia.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Batte in Washington. Today is Monday, September 20. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta will lead high-level presidential engagements at the United Nations Security Council in October this year, as Kenya holds the presidency of the Peace and Security Organ for a month. Kenya's Foreign Affairs Cabinet Secretary, Ambassador Rachel Omamo, addressing members of the diplomatic corps in Nairobi, said discussions will center on finding solutions to African problems, especially on peace and security. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, Kenya says its agenda will focus on resolving vaccine inequality, refugee problems, insecurity, and climate change.
Kenya is set to chair the United Nations Security Council with plans to use the opportunity to push solutions for problems like terrorism and climate change. The country's Foreign Affairs Cabinet Secretary Rachel Omamo said that Kenya will make its views known at both the United Nations General Assembly and Security Council on why the world must encourage a practice where Africans take leading positions in the affairs.
There will be one on identity, state building and peace, which will look at the challenge of diversity, on governance and on peace and on inclusion. Then there will be another engagement by the head of state later on at the end of October, which will be a virtual engagement, and it will be on African solutions around the Africa peace and security architecture and how we can improve that through engagements with Africa's sub-regional mechanisms.
Kenya and other African countries claim that the council as constituted is biased against Africa, having no veto-holding member from the continent. Omamo said that the world will never solve African problems unless it places the continent in charge of the search for solutions. She says Africa is looking for ways to silence the guns.
That will be a very important discussion because it will help us try and find ways and means to silence the guns in Africa using the Africa peace and security architecture to silence the guns on our continent.
The General Assembly will be tackling issues such as food systems, climate change, global governance, and regional peace and security. The British High Commissioner to Kenya, Jane Marriott, has called for climate action to deal with climatic changes in Kenya and Africa.
The Great Britain is holding a conference in a few weeks' time to talk about climate change and the impact it is having on ordinary people's lives. And we need to explain to those at the very top in power the impact that their decisions have on the lives of ordinary people. And my job is to help create space so African voices can be heard at that conference in the UK. Climate change is not something happening over there. It's something you are living, we are living every single day.
Kenya will be taking on a bigger task in October when it takes the presidency of the UN Security Council for the first time in 22 years. With Kenya being a non-permanent member of the UN most powerful body, Kenya says it will use the occasion to ensure people listen to Africa. President Kenyatta will seek views from members on how the growing technological revolution, urbanization, inequality, environmental degradation, and population growth have contributed to rise of conflict in Africa. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
The World Health Organization is warning that COVID-19 vaccine export bans by wealthy countries will prolong the pandemic in Africa, preventing recovery from the disease in the rest of the world. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
While more than 60% of the U.S., European Union, and British populations have been vaccinated, only 2% of COVID vaccine shots have been given in Africa. The COVAX facility has slashed its planned COVID-19 vaccine deliveries to Africa by 25% this year. World Health Organization Africa Regional Director Matshidiso Moeti says the 470 million doses now expected to arrive by the end of September are enough to vaccinate just 17% of Africans on the continent.
Export bans and vaccine hoarding still have a chokehold on the lifeline of vaccine supplies to Africa. Even if all planned shipments via COVAX and the African Union arrive, Africa still needs almost 500 million more doses to reach the year-end goal. At this rate, the continent may only reach the 40% target by the end of March next year.
WHO reports more than 8 million cases of COVID-19 in Africa, including more than 200,000 deaths. 44 African countries have reported the Alpha variant, and 32 countries have reported the more virulent and contagious Delta variant. Moeti warns of further waves of infection and loss of life in this pandemic. Given the short supply of vaccines, she urges strict adherence to preventive measures such as mask wearing and social distancing. She reiterates WHO's call for a halt to booster shots in wealthy nations, except for those with compromised immune systems and at risk of severe illness and death.
I've said many times that it's in everyone's interest to make sure the most at-risk groups in every country are protected. As it stands, the huge gaps in vaccine equity is not closing anywhere near fast enough. The quickest way to end this pandemic is for countries with reserves to release their doses so that other countries can buy them.
Moeti says African countries with low vaccination rates are breeding grounds for vaccine-resistant variants. She warns this could end up sending the world back to square one. She says the pandemic will continue to ravage communities worldwide if vaccine inequity continues. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in Cameroon, where the Confederation of African Football President Dr. Patrice Motsepe is delighted that the 2022 CAF African host is on track with preparations for the biggest football spectacle on the African continent come 2022. The CAF president was in Cameroon at the weekend, where he inspected the Olympi Stadium in Yaoundé, which will host the opening match and the finals of the AFCON in January and February of 2022. The president said that he was satisfied with the briefing he got and what he saw at the Olympic Stadium, describing it as world-class.
I'm excited that we're going to do very well to showcase the facilities and the quality of football worldwide, but also showcase this beautiful country and the talented people. Cameroon has produced some of the most talented Africans that have made us proud and that has made the rest of the continent proud.
Staying with football news, Turkish tactician Engin Firat was on Sunday afternoon unveiled as Harambee Stars' new coach on a 2-month contract in Nairobi. Football Kenya Federation President Nick Manonwa said the former Moldova national head coach's sole target will be to ensure Harambee Stars finishes top of Group E and get to the next round of World Cup qualifiers.
We wanted somebody who can look at the task and be prepared to take that task with what we have. And so as a result, Mr. Engin will have an engagement for 2 months to take on the 4 qualifiers that remain. Mali away and home on 8th and 12th of October, and then Uganda away in November and Rwanda at home. And then we will discuss if to continue and how to continue if we are continuing.
Coach Firat, on his own part, said he's looking forward to the challenge.
Said Kenya is a real football country, a lot of fans, and people expect a lot. And I believe there is a chance to do something, even if it's difficult. But this is in the end also something what motivates a person. And I'm very motivated now, and I'm very hopeful for this challenge.
And now to some basketball news. It was day two on Sunday in the ongoing FIBA Women AfroBasket Cameroon 2021 Championships, as the two-time African champion Angola had to fall back on their A game to be able to wait off a stiff challenge from Mozambique, beating the ladies from Maputo 70-61. Mozambique's coach Nasser Sale was full of praises.
This is second day, second game, and now we must take for the next phase.
Yeah. In the second game of the day, Egypt were ruthless over Guinea as they joined Senegal and Mali as the three teams to reach a 100-point mark when they handed Guinea their second defeat in Group C, winning by 102-58. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, September 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Barty wishing you will have a great week.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.